Welcome to our last reading of the semester. I want to begin by telling you that next semester we're going to have three visiting writers also, who I hope you'll want to hear, all very good writers. In February, on February 9th, Lucille Clifton will be reading. And then on March 1st, James Galvin will be reading. And on March 12th, John Anderson will be reading his poem. So we'll have another good semester of art. High art, low art, and middle art. Okay. My first encounter with David Wojahn was a penetrating interview he did with the poet Norman Doobie in the American Poetry Review. His strong critical intelligence made me curious about his own poems. Later, I saw poems of David's in The New Yorker and Poetry. And finally, in 1982, his Ice House Lights was selected by Richard Hugo to win the most prestigious first book award, the Yale Series of Younger Poets competition. And as you might know, the Yale Series is has a history that David will have to live up to of some of the greatest American poets since World War II, including Adrian Rich, John Ashbery, James Wright, W.S. Merwin, and James Tate, all of whom have won the Yale Award. It's easy to see, though, even in a first book, why David's poems are so appealing. He does bring that strong intelligence, which was first revealed in his critical interviews, to his work. And it's also interesting to see what a gentle, sympathetic, observant male brings to the world of poetry. In many of the poems, Wojahn explores his sympathy with others, his struggle with his own family of origin, his love relationships, and the problems of the self-conscious intellectual, which is that of perspective and immobility, and also the question of what is it like to be an outsider, a question which all of us in the privacy of our own lives must ask. His poems are thoughtfully written, reveries, and they're also carefully written with a great respect for how language forms feeling. Without self-pity, he talks about the wounded heart, the frustrated desires for intimacy. David's an active and busy person in the poetry world. He's reviewed, he's interviewed, and now he edits poetry for one of the livelier literary journals, Crazy Horse. He teaches at the University of Arkansas, and this year is writing full-time at the Provincetown. Did I say he was teaching full-time? He's writing full-time. He is in the luxury of leisure in the isolated sand dunes of Provincetown at the Provincetown Fine Arts Center. I was selected for a fellowship there. I also would like to welcome you all after the reading to come down and join David and me and I hope a whole bunch of other people at Silver Street, where we'll all drink and talk very seriously about the quality of drink at Silver Street. And you might get to know David better. He's a lovely person and a very good poet. Please welcome David Wojahn.
Thank you. Can you hear me? Chad, look. Can you hear me without the mic? This microphone isn't amplifying anything, right? Okay. I'll start with a poem I wrote right after I moved to Arizona. And one of the things that's really extraordinary about going to Arizona, if you've been in any other area of the country, is that there's still this kind of frontier boom mentality about Tucson and Phoenix. So the curious thing is that there's always activity, particularly always construction. So at the first place I lived when I was in Tucson, there was a housing development going out, or an apartment complex being built across the street from us. And not only was it being built on the weekends, Saturday, Sunday, but even at night, there'd be workmen there. And finally, whenever I'd get to write in the evening, like 9 or 10 o'clock, I'd see the same person across the street working on the apartment building, same individual. And so I'd be writing, looking out my window, and he'd be doing these weird things in the apartment building. So we ended up having this kind of curiously symbiotic relationship over the course of a couple of months. So that's in there. The other thing in it is Japanese erotic woodcuts. There's a reference to those. If you've ever seen Japanese erotic woodcuts, they're very interesting. For one principal reason is you have these couples in these wild and wonderful gyrations, but they almost always have scarves stuffed in their mouths. And the Japanese are very polite people, and they have the houses usually have paper walls, so there's a reason of expedience for this. Poem's called Distance. Tonight the workmen with red bandanas are building a house across the street. Light spills from the holes they've left for windows. They've inched across the roof beams, buckets of shingles in their arms. This last man leans after everyone's gone, his head on a door that's propped on a tree. I hear him singing to himself. We both can't sleep. His singing and his hand that drums a hammer again and again into the ground. The cats on the roof disturb him. He stares and hammers, hears me typing, or finds me through the window, bent to my lamp. I've come to admire the distance between us, the noises we make to ourselves in the night, tired as the lovers in a Japanese print, who've turned and wiped their genitals with the blue silk scarves they'd stuffed in their mouths while coupling. I never grew up in Arizona, though I grew up in Minnesota, you know, the land of 10,000 lakes, right? And one of the things that's important about Minnesota is it means, therefore, that every important life decision you make is made around a lake. And this is a poem that does that. It's about my mother. And the strangest thing about my mother and my aunt as I was growing up is that there'd been a long tradition in my family of investigating the occult. I had an aunt who was the head of the Spiritualist Church of America. And so both my mother and my aunt, I had a great aunt who was in the Spiritualist Church, were very into occult phenomena. And it's so disturbing, you know, when you're 4 or 5 years old and you have very little ability to distinguish reality from unreality anyway, to have your mother and aunt playing around with a Ouija board and calling up spirits of dead relatives. This poem is a little bit about that. It's called The Astral Body. And in occult terminology, of course, the astral body is sort of the shadow body to the physical body, the body the soul inhabits. It leaves the body in sleep and, of course, leaves the body in death, too. So it's written from a time that was very difficult for my mother, the astral body. My handwriting's big, like grazing cattle. I'm learning cursive on the dock, the summer that polio twists my mother's legs. I write as she reads me the fable of the prince who was sleepless for 100 years. There's always a broken heart, and I know sleepless nights are already a spell. White gauze, the curtains too are a spell. I wake. By yellow bulb, Aunt Hope and Mother play cards on the porch all evening. I look out on the lake where the misty undead skim the water by moonlight. The face at the window is only a branch, though it's breathing and calling my name. Aunt Hope says, we'll enter the astral body. We'll give off light and be crippled by light. The prince who is sleepless will rise into light. My aunt lifts Mother up from the table, darkens the lamp. They stare at the water that hurts as it shimmers. The astral body is also pain, all pulsation and memory. It is not dark wood or a walnut door. It is not a staircase my mother won't climb. Mother, when you're nothing but starlight that drills through the curtains, when you're mist I can slice with my hands, I'll wake like this, want to rise up, cold, touching the light you've become. This next poem sort of a companion piece to that. It's a poem for my father. And the thing that I think is most important about my father, was most important to me when I was growing up, is that he was probably in the last generation of real railroad men. He worked for the Great Northern Railroad for a period of about 26 years. And when I was growing up, when I was a small kid, he was always going to these places that I thought were terribly exotic, like Fargo, North Dakota, and Winnipeg, Manitoba, and Spearfish, Montana. And I sort of remember my father during that period when he was doing that. And what would happen if you were on the railroad is you'd be gone for a week and then home for a week. He was happy then. It was probably the only time in my father's life I remember him being happy. And in about 1970, Amtrak took over the management of a lot of the smaller independent railroads, like the Great Northern, Northern Pacific, the Milwaukee Road. And my father was one of thousands of people who'd been working there for years and years and lost his job. And so a pretty depressing and bitter period ensued for him. That's mentioned in the poem. It takes place in the restaurant. It's called Heaven for Railroad Men. "You're still a young man," he says, not to his son. It's his bitterness he's talking to, and at the restaurant, he orders a fourth round before dinner. With mother wiping her glasses at the table, I help him from his chair to the john. He pees slowly, fingers like hams on his fly, a complex test of logic for a man this drunk. I'm splashing cold water in his face, and he tells me he's dying. "Don't say a thing to your mother, and please, Dave, don't ever remember me like this." I remember how you said you needed to ride the baggage cars forever, passing prairie towns where silos squat like pepper shakers on dry earth. I want to be six again and sway with you down the sagging rails to Minot, Winnipeg, and beyond, your mail sacks piled like foothills of the Rockies. You're unloading your government colt, unzipping your suitcase for Canadian inspectors. Father, when I touched you, I was trembling. Heaven for Railroad Men begins with a collapsed trestle. The engine goes steaming off into nothing. There are no rails to hold you. You're singing country western at the top of your lungs. You go flying forever, the door pulled open, mail sacks scattered into space like seed. This next poem is also sort of peripherally involved with my family. One of the strange things about my background is that both my paternal grandfather and my maternal grandmother both went blind in middle age. Both went blind from glaucoma. And if you know anything about glaucoma, it's sort of a degenerative eye disease that the curious thing about it is it seems that they don't know how it starts, but it seems to be hereditary. It also seems to skip a generation, so that I have a kind of predisposition coming from both sides of my family, which is terribly frightening. And when I wrote this poem, I was having a lot of problems with my eyes, and I was going in several times a month for eye exams for something that they couldn't really determine what was wrong with me. And I was living in Arizona, and I was living out in the desert foothills, and I'd drive in every day to Tucson. And the very first thing that you would see as a kind of sign of civilization beyond the desert, right past the city limits, was this huge complex of the Arizona School for the Blind. And large campus, very large campus. And the thing that was so strange about it was that I'd see the same, at this crosswalk, there'd be the same students every morning when I'd be driving in to work or driving in for these eye exams, the same students walking across the crosswalk. And so I eventually ended up having, you know, little narratives that I'd give to myself about them. So they're in there. My grandmother, some memories of my grandmother. It's here, too. It's a poem in four sections. I'm just going to pause between each section. It's called Glaucoma. There's an olive grove inside the fence that circles the home for the blind. a drive each day past the gate, where they come to the crosswalk in mismatched couples, having one great thing in common. I'm braked, motor off, making up names. There's sightless Elena leaning on the stoplight, 12-year-old Samuel gripping her wrist. Redhead Anya drops her cane to the curb, stops the traffic as she searches. I always picture their dorms at night. Roommates, Anya and Elena, drink wine after lights out. The gray, forbidden cat nudges their knees for food. Elena pours too much milk, filling the bowl from fingertip to knuckle. At first, the drops sting. The nurse holds my pulse and offers me gum. This is the third test in a month, various lenses. I watch the doctor's forehead underwater. G, P, X, R. I have to correct myself twice. Glaucoma, pressure on the retina, subtle nerves. Some, like my grandmother, go crazy from it, more than blind. I can't concentrate. I'm five again at midnight, awake to grandmother carrying blankets to my bed. In the morning, I'll stare at smudges her hands made for years along the walls. See her turn from the dress pattern, laid out clumsy on the table, her mouth full of pins. After bourbon all night, we undress with the lights on. Do it in front of the closet mirror. You're on top with eyes half closed when I ask you to look at my face. Grab my neck and look at my face. Your back's arched forward, hair across my chest. The first warm night this winter, we open windows to the lights in the valley. No one should be permitted to love the moon, you say. And each night it's smaller for me, even tonight, full. I wake from the dream where grandmother leads me along the walls of an endless house, stucco cutting our palms. I sit up, touch your sleeping face, try to imagine blindness. One hand across my eyes, the other on the oranges, the wicker basket. Still life in darkness, oranges, dwarf stars colliding. In the valley, Elena's asleep in her chair. Anya wraps her arms around the cat. She's decided his eyes are green, his fur is brown and streaked with silver. Next poem I'm going to read is entitled Miracles, and let me first explain what a miracle is, okay? Or at least in the context of the poem, if you go down to any of the missions in the Southwest, you'll find that the general pattern is to have an effigy of the patron saint of the mission in a little alcove over to the right or the left of the altar. And it's usually a wooden effigy of the patron saint that's lying out on a slab. And it's usually dressed in a white robe. And over this white robe are festooned with all of these little charms of trinkets about yay big. These are miracles. And what you're supposed to do if you have a particular problem is buy a miracle in the shape of the problem and bring it to the saint and, you know, and attach it to the raiment of the saint, the garment of the saint. And then supposedly the saint is going to intercede. So you find these strangely kind of constellation-like bodies of the saints laid out. And this weird variety of miracles. It's not simply things like, you know, arms and legs, so you have ears, but strange things like tractors and television sets. They're miracles for just about anything. So that's in the poem. A couple of other things in it. It's a reference to black holes, and I'm sure you know what a black hole is. The light will not escape from it. We can conceivably see the light of a star that's been dead for many years, but we're seeing old light. The most important thing about it, though, is it was written for A friend of mine had visited me shortly after his sister had died. Her sister had been murdered. It's called Miracles. It's from Mary Logue. It's in four sections. I'll just pause between them. You phoned from Minnesota when your sister died, murdered by a stranger in her bed. Your father, 2 days later, found her body. In long distance, there was little I could say. I thought of how I'd watched sometimes my body from the ceiling as it slept, but knew that I'd return and wake, stare as the room would shudder into view, and I would join myself again. Later, with Steve, you came to visit, and after picnic at Hanging Rock, a film both lovely and unbearable, where the dead do not simply die, but disappear and endure somehow, we heard you walk through the house near dawn, all night unable to sleep. In Mexico next day, we ate and drank in a restaurant in a cave, turistas overlooking the border fence. In the mission of San Javier del Bac, the saints have wooden bodies. The faithful bring them candles and silver charms no larger than a fingernail. Miracles. Parts of the body they pray will soon be cured. Hands and Egyptian eyes, cartoon feet, head in profile for the comatose, so they will wake again, leave the blue vaults of heaven, and come home. The raiments of the saints, pinned with them like burrs or constellations, the immensity of loss on the smallest imaginable scale. The man in the shop took an interest in us and showed us a bag of thousands, cows and sheep and children, even a crude eight-pointed star. Feeling foolish, we carried dozens in a paper sack across the border. Driving home that night, I remembered how you and I had lived one summer in the borrowed house on the Mississippi, took our meals on the terrace, just oranges and cheese. And the woman next door would always wave, watering ferns and nasturtiums. She would tell us about Poland and the war, how in time even Poland became consoling. Since memory becomes revision, like sentiment and foolish songs, we smooth our past and our loss until they're simple. Ignore the fight she had with her son. Evening she'd visit us drunk and weeping. Night we called the ambulance for her. The medics with their doubled fists upon her chest. I wanted to remember her serene, though her face was blue with pain. She asked you to hurry next door for her Medal of St. Christopher. Some Polish inscription she read out loud to no one. Tight Cyrillic letters on the back. And Mary. What we bring from the dead is small, memory and gesture. The way someone looked during a picnic once, holding a black and yellow moth by the tips of its wings to show you, her hair obscuring her eyes. Like the star, Ancharian 10, and the constellation of the swan, dead tonight, over 20 years. So there is no light at the end of its beam we see. Only its darkness, compressed and final. I would like us to walk out of our hearts under the looming, abundant sky. I would like us to pray. And you and I can stand all night and search the sky for the dead, who are larger now than ever thought, more distant and enduring. And we are the source of what shines down. I think I'm going to read some new poems, which I never do, because I always like to let the poems like steep for a year or so before I decide to read them. But I'm going to read some very recent ones. And it occurred to me, just very naively at one point, very, very recently, that sometimes my poems are grim. that there's a sort of obsessively elegiac fashion to them. So I wanted to write a poem, or some poems, that seem a little bit more, well, if not happy, at least sort of remotely celebratory. This is a new poem. There are a couple of things that are in it. First of all, this is the most literary thing in the poem. There's a reference to a Turkish poet named Nazım Hikmet. And Nazım Hikmet is the great Turkish poet of the century. And there are two things that are wonderful about him, or important about him, I think I should say, is he was terrifically prolific, terrifically optimistic in this believable sense in his poems. And yet he spent most of his life in prison because he was a Marxist. And so the authorities, about three times, threw him into a prison in Istanbul, where he did a lot of writing, but suffered enormously. And yet his poems are really wonderful. In fact, one of the books in English is titled Things I Didn't Know I Loved, which I really strongly recommend for you. That's in there. The other thing that's in there is my next-door neighbor in Provincetown, who's an 80-year-old Marxist named Philly Alexander. And Philly Alexander is probably the greatest gardener in Provincetown, and he's also been the gardener for everybody. So I'll go over, and he'll give me these enormous gifts of dahlias and all sorts of food and vegetables, and he'll tell me stories about the people he's gardened for. He's gardened for, like, O'Neill and Dispassos and Norman Mailer and all. And the thing about it, though, is he's very literate. He's very intelligent. But if you ask him, well, what was Dispassos like? He said, oh, his yard was terrible. You know, so he's in it. And it's also the most important thing. It's kind of a love poem, and I've never read it before. So it's called Dates, for example. Branches nodding in the sun. The trees are bruised with afternoon light. I'm watching Phil Alexander next door stoop to purple dahlia blossoms, larger than a hat. He brings his cukes, late plum tomatoes, oxeye daisies in jars, recipes in a wavering hand for kale soup and chowder. The gardener for Dispassos and O'Neill, his anecdotes commence with roses, the Japanese elm in O'Neill's yard, the way Dispassos cut his lawn and hair. A big man with a cowlick he was, had the first power mower on the Cape. From a book by a Turkish poet I read, dates, for example, are very important to Hikmet. The date of the poem is part of the poem itself. It's the 3rd of October, 1983, and I'm listening to Linda's typewriter hesitantly clatter the stanzas of a poem I would like Nazım Hikmet, 20 years dead this month, to read with approval over her hunched-down shoulders, under the shimmering, supernoval water lilies of Monet's Giverny adorning her wall. I want him to read her lines from his prison cell in Istanbul, exclaiming like a child when a phrase seems right, saying, this would sound almost as good in Turkish, saying, woman, your hair is a steady pulsing lily made of light. He will talk with her this way for hours. The plummeting sun disperses its light on the 100 masts of sloops and freighters in the port of Istanbul below his window. It's evening now. The bars of the window marry the first steady darkness until they seem to waver and disappear. Nazım Hikmet removes his glasses, cups his hand around the single candle he's issued this week. And Phil Alexander, with garden shears, is pounding the doorframe behind me. I brought you some rhubarb. I brought you some peppers. I don't know. It's different. I sort of go back on my word of writing, optimistic poems with this one, but I think it's optimistic in a certain sense. This is an elegy for Richard Hugo, who I never met. I spoke with on the phone once. And yet his poems, in a very strange way, have meant a lot to me over the years. And so this is a poem that's both an elegy and a kind of homage to Richard Hugo's work. If you don't know Richard Hugo's work, you really should, because he writes a kind of poem that's different from anybody else's. The things that are important about Hugo's work, I think, are that one of the big themes is his interest in desolation, his interest in abandoned towns, in northwestern ghost towns, towns where the mines have come and gone and there's no one left but a few drunks staggering around the street. And the thing that's very amazing to me about Hugo is that after he called me and told me I'd won the Yale Prize, the thing that I did is I went out to this town about 5 miles away from where I was living then in Minnesota called Hugo, Minnesota. And Hugo, Minnesota has a population now of about 300. And I finally sent him these black and white photos of Hugo, which had nothing anymore, a deserted station, a deserted water tower. So I sort of thought of that when after Dick Hugo died. So the poem is called Particular Words. It's in blank verse. Only once we spoke, this long distance, about the hyperbolic forward to a book. You wrote of someone almost me, but better. Today, your death's a year and continent away. Rain and torrents lathers the Cape. The beach is shining out from mist until you'd think we stood on Puget, gazing west, guessing the sunset's color. Now you're the past. That's all. Now you're what we leave behind, the way the sea leaves indiscriminate stones. A fireplace and stairway stand above the charred foundation of a lighthouse and Coast Guard barracks. The stairway creaks and feels drunk. On top, you can bellow your name to the salt spray until it echoes back, or until your lungs get tired. And you stroll off to some house a mile up the beach, a big man fumbling in his raincoat for the key. So let's say you come in drenched. Let's say I'm here to meet you, a fifth of Jack, the fire going. So now at last it's time for talk. Naturally, there's some silence at first, discomfort of strangers I've only met in poems. But also, my story of an honest Minnesota ghost town called Hugo, where I drove when someone phoned with the news. Embarrassing, the photos I took. The water tower flounders above Lapse Meadows with your name. The gold medal grain mill glowers over a few sick elms. It's wind, not drunks, that weaves the streets, having traveled all night from Billings and Bozeman, like distant cousins you'd rather avoid. But you know the story. All towns die the same, but come back different as lies we tell to make each town more whole when lost. Particular words get repeated for effect. Humiliation, don't come back, remission, death. They write them into each town charter. Honest lies we tell to soothe us, Dick, to give these sorrows form. A couple more poems from the book. Ira asked me to read this poem, which I've hardly ever read at a reading, so I think it'll work out all right. It's a poem about Buddy Holly. And the thing that's terrible about Buddy Holly now is that no one remembers who Buddy Holly... Do you remember who Buddy Holly was? Okay, good. Now, Buddy Holly was, you know, a great rock and roller, and unfortunately he died in a plane crash in Clear Lake, Iowa in 1960. Yeah, 1960. And... 59 or 60, he died in a plane crash. And... So Buddy Holly's in here, and the poem was prompted by a small article in the back of the newspaper that said that, of course, Buddy Holly's signature was his glasses, these really horrible-looking horn-rimmed glasses, and they'd been found in a county morgue locker in Clear Lake, Iowa. This is about 1979. That's there. The other thing that's probably more important, is probably why I wrote the poem, is I had a very good friend in Arizona who... His wife had died a couple of years before I knew him, and he was a widower. He had a small son, and he was a Buddy Holly fanatic. He'd get horribly drunk and listen to these Buddy Holly songs until all these odd hours in the morning. And the thing that he did finally is he taught his son to do a kind of Buddy Holly imitation. But it's not funny. In a very curious way, it's a very tender gesture. And the poem's about a lot of that. It's called Buddy Holly. What there's been of winter moves away, and after dawn it's warm again. Another easy thing to sentimentalize. I walked this morning with the dog around a tiny artificial lake among swans and eucalyptus and read a Buddy Holly in the Sunday Globe. Dead 20 years, his shattered glasses from the plane crash, rediscovered in a county morgue locker in Clear Lake, Iowa. We talked of this, Hank and I, over beers and underdone chicken. And nights when he drinks alone in his house, Hank plays Buddy Holly until dawn. How much, he asked last night, would those glasses be worth today? I told him thousands, thousands. How much can we remove from the dead for our private, selfish use? Buddy Holly died younger than I am today. We dusted off the old LPs and tried as best we could to mourn him. He once said he wanted to come back from the dead, he and his child bride, as swans, because they're beautiful, because they're mates for life. There's Hank's wife in the photo, before her death, before the unappeasable lingering. Sammy in her arms in Boston. Hank's taught Sammy to sing Buddy Holly. And a voice that makes you certain he understands. To stand in a chair and hoot and mime a perfect electric guitar. Moonlit dance pavilion, the wind now hushed. The reverie of moments when everything beyond the singer stills. And only the dead are breathing. Their hands cupped gently to whisper again their names into our ears. Just a few more. Three more. This is a poem. It's odd. I lived in Provincetown on the Cape about 3 years ago, and now I'm back there again, and suddenly I realize how different I am now. I was very morose and solipsistic at that point, and this is a morose and solipsistic poem. But I had a morose and solipsistic year when I was there. And the thing that sort of triggered me to the fact it would be a morose and solipsistic year was that the very first day I went there, I was walking down the main street, and there was this huge crowd gathered around the town pier. And I went to investigate, and there was this large whale that had beached itself that day. And the whale was covered with tablecloths, these checkered tablecloths, that the waiters from all the restaurants had dipped in water and covered the whale with so that the whale wouldn't die of exposure and dehydration. So that's there. But mostly it's a kind of soured love poem, I guess. It's called Another Coast. The woman singing in the house next door draws her bath, a country western song. Someone's heart is broken in El Paso. And she pulls the shades. We've never spoken, but nights I watch her set the table for her lover who visits weekends. And outside fillets the bluefish he's just caught. Later, they'll tip glasses on the balcony. Animated talk, then such composure on their faces. Pointless now to say how things should have been better with us. The way I miss you makes the days portentous. Trees not simply barren. And I walk the tapered streets of this seaside town. Inns all shuttered. Faltering shingles. Yesterday, a bottlenosed dolphin beached herself beyond the pier and lived for hours. The cafe waiters checkered her with tablecloths that dipped in seawater to keep her damp and breathing. A crowd had gathered, and the next-door couple with their shiny Nikon argued loudly about who should take the picture. Years ago, another coast. We fought all evening in the small apartment, finally sleeping in separate corners. Several times we woke, not thinking there was more to say, and later stood a long time at the window, to watch the taverns' blurry neons, mugs and dancing glasses, going out in sequence before the dark, where man and woman stood to batter each other haplessly, breaking bottles on the street, but not upon themselves. Maybe some bruises, a little blood. Finished, they embraced and parted. The woman shouting, call me when you get up. I think it's strange about that poem is for years I couldn't figure out why I would make the connection between that bar that people would leave and then the dead dolphin, right? And finally I realized that the bar that everyone was leaving was called the Green Dolphin Bar. And that visual pun triggered the poem, but it was years later before I realized that it happened. Two more poems. One of my earliest childhood memories is, again, growing up in Minnesota and standing up on a chair to look out the window and seeing on the frozen lake in the wintertime, they have fish, they must have fish houses up here, right? Okay, seeing people at night in fish houses, and seeing the lights from those fish houses on the frozen lake. And it's one of those memories, you know, those terribly early childhood memories that seem to have completely emblazoned themselves in your mind for no particular reason, but they still seem to come back obsessively in this kind of weirdly Proustian way again and again and again. That's in the poem. The other thing is that's in it is this strange and marvelous book by a Russian psychologist who was a contemporary and associate of Pavlov named A.L. Luria. And Luria wrote this bizarre and tragic book called The Mind of a Nemesist. And The Mind of the Nemesist is a case study of a man who had total recall. And this guy was completely debilitated, completely handicapped by the fact that he remembered everything. And the fact that he remembered everything caused him to be able to put nothing into perspective. Everything was immediately available to him, which sounds funny, right, when you think about it. But the thing that was horrible about him is he would do things like, if Luria would ask him, remember the death of your first wife, and he would immediately just break into tears because he couldn't remember anything as much as continually relive events. So the book is studied, The Mind of Nemesist, A Study in Memory Pathology. So I was reading the book at a fairly crucial period in my life. So it's called Cold Glow Ice Houses. Because the light this morning is recondite, like figures behind curtains from a long way off. Because the morning is cold and this room is heatless, I've gone without sleep, I brood. The protocol of memory, the faucet dripping into a sponge, then thinking of the way I saw White Bear Lake freeze over 20 years ago in Minnesota, the carp oblivious below. I thought last night of Solomon Petrov, a Ukrainian rabbi in my college science books, afflicted with total recall, a pathological memory that made perspective impossible. Once, for doctors, he remembered running for a train in Petersburg in winter. They recorded his quickened pulse, body temperature plunging. The death by fever of his first wife, Tanya, was not remembered, but continually relived. And memory is not accomplishment. Last night, again, you described for me our child pulled dead from your womb. In sleep, you talk to yourself and the child, who passed unnamed, wholly into memory. Now you wanted peace, some distance. And every memory, said Solomon Petrov, must proceed unchanged in the mind, going on like smoke to designate itself again. Like the second floor window where I stood as a boy to watch the fishermen park their cars on the lake. Ice house lights in the evening below. Or our child, whose name is only ash, is only a thought too hurtful to free. Mornings like these, he floats at the window, waiting and mouthing his name, there through a tangent of ice, his face and hands a shimmer. If you know anything about William Carlos Williams poems, I subvert a line of the most famous William Carlos Williams poems, The Descent, which Williams wrote after he'd had a stroke. There's a line about memory is an accomplishment because it opens realms heretofore unrealized. And I think one of the things that inspired the poem was trying to work against that idea. So memory is not accomplishment. This poem is called Flower, and it's the last poem I'll read. It's F-L-O-U-R. I don't think I've ever written an F-L-O-W-E-R flower poem. It's got my parents in it. I wrote it when I was living on Cape Cod the last time I was there. So there's a lot of low tide ice, that sort of thing in it. The important thing about it is that it's got a reference to Vermeer. Do you know of the painter Vermeer, who was Dutch? He lived in Delft. He was sort of a contemporary of Rembrandt, and a much greater painter, I think, in so many ways. The thing that's wonderful about Vermeer is he was able to capture a moment of ordinary everyday experience, ordinary everyday reality, in a way that was vibrant enough to be almost spiritual, almost mystical. So you have, there are very few paintings that remain by Vermeer, so only about 30 or 40 of them, usually with the same models, the same room, the same props in it, come back again and again. So Vermeer is sort of in it, my parents are sort of in it, I'm in it. It's in three sections. I'll just pause between them. Flower. Because her hands are freckled, she's rubbed them with a special cream. Waking early on Thanksgiving morning, 1955. My mother polishes her mother's silver. Tired or bored, she gives the chamois cloth to me. Outside, the sky arranges itself for snow as my father, on the road in Spearfish, leans from the baggage car door to catch a single flake in his glove. He knows the train will follow snow all day east to Minneapolis, viscous ice already on the river. And we bends to a thermos, feet propped on a stranger's coffin, bound express for Fond du Lac. 25 years have passed, and I wake in a room in Massachusetts to scan the low tide ice beyond my window. Mornings like these, I can't complete my parents' faces or my own. Father dozing between Alexandria and Fergus Falls. Mother in her mother's scarf, setting out sumac for sparrows. Mornings like these, I'm five again, and waving at the window to her figure in the snow. A moment so composed, I want it back. My breath, an almost perfect circle. In all his work, there's only one window in a single room. Only the clean swept tiles of a bourgeois house. But also, says Proust of Vermeer, our lives are ennobled as heightened gestures of perspective. The face and hands of the maiden pouring milk, the wall map of Europe with its compass points, clouds with human faces. All this is reflected in the luster of a copper bowl, in the blonde girl's languid hands. Timeless in light, the distance captivating. This is the grand deception, that the painter holds us here, the world he denies us immense and perfectly arranged. My painter friend said Vermeer made her weep for what she couldn't have. All afternoon, the first November snow had clarified the fields, roads disengaged from trees and houses. By evening, only stillness. As I walked, I came back to myself, the single gesture the landscape made, continually shifting, as if I could glimpse from the corner of my eye my father turning endlessly the red lid of the thermos, mother in her mother's scarf setting out sumac for sparrows, arthritic Vermeer as he lifts his daughter's wrist to pose. I wanted to tell you I was comforted by this. In 1955, I grew lost in the winter forest beyond our house. Only snow light late evening. Stepping free of the elms to the vista of home, the porch light, and mother calling, was a way of seeing my life diminish to landscape blurred particulars. I might now tell you I was tranquil then, a self beyond conception. Mother had been baking, mother in the doorway in its wedge of light, dusted to her elbows with flour, bending to cup my face in her hands, delicately whitening the cheek and forehead of her son. Thank you.